Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jonathan Larson of the University of Nebraska.
And I'm your other host today, Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
And we are coming at you today, very excited to talk to you a little bit about, we're going to cover a couple of different topics, but it's all sort of the same ball of wax. We're going to talk about apitherapy and also...
I see what you did there with ball of wax.
Also, bee venom therapy more specifically, yes. I try to be as clever as I can on the podcast, Mike. I know it doesn't happen in real life very often. So we are excited to be back. I know we took a bit of an extended holiday break. It turned into Christmas break, and then it turned into sort of I got sick, Mike got sick, Jody had snow days. It just turned into lots of problems. So we're back. Happy to be bringing you some entomological earbud entertainment now. So let's start this episode by talking just a little bit about honeybees, Mike. It's one of everybody's favorite insects. I would call them charismatic microfauna. Would you agree with that?
That's true. I would maybe call them the cows of the insect world.
Ooh, tell me more about that. Why do you call them that?
Because they're more of a livestock and less of like a wild animal.
That's
we
true.
We raise them. They do our bidding for us. They're partially domesticated or... Domesticated in a different sense, maybe than cows, but I've seen a couple articles recently arguing that while protecting honeybees is great, you know, that doesn't really get at protecting biodiversity as a whole. You need to look at other things too. So when you think about honeybees, you should maybe think of them more like cattle, and how protecting cows doesn't really protect, like, the landscape and buffalo and birds and that kind of thing.
I think that's a very fair point. We have a long, long history with honeybees. I think Gene Kritsky has a book out there about the Tears of Ray, and he talks a lot about how we've been raising bees for a long time. We have cultural mythology that surrounds them. The Tears of Ray is about the fact that the Egyptians thought that bees were from the tears of their sun god, and they loved them, and they reared them, and they burnt incense to kind of calm them down and kept them in clay tubes. And we love bees so much, we brought them with us as European colonists to the North American continent. So really, kind of an invasive species, I would argue.
Depending on how you look at it, it could be. And that's something a lot of people don't realize, is bees aren't native to North America. They're not supposed to be here.
Honeybees.
Honeybees, yes. Right. There are many species of native bees,
right?
Which is why... when you look at native or at least crops that originated in North America, they're not pollinated by honeybees. Squash originated in Central America and Mexico and are pollinated by squash bees, and honeybees don't touch them.
Well, they're better pollinated by squash bees for sure. Honeybees can rob from them, if I remember a squash farmer talking.
I think you're right.
Yeah, they can get in there and steal the nectar without actually getting any of the pollen on them. So... they're not always the best pollinator, but we do like them because they visit so many of our crops. They are transported around for almond production and apple production. They get them on flatbed trucks and move them from state to state.
Yeah, and that's a good point, is they're really easy to use. They may not be the best pollinators, but they're the easiest to use. You don't have to do, like, you just keep them in their boxes, and you don't have to, like, modify the environment around your fields to entice them to come nest there or... forage there.
They're like a Leatherman multi-tool, almost, of pollination.
Yes. Maybe not the best when you've got other tools available, but right. If it's all you got...
yeah, you're going to use it. This show is not brought to you by Leatherman multi-tools. They haven't offered us a deal yet, but maybe after this episode.
Maybe.
So, they're livestock. We transport them around. We brought them with us. We have a long-standing history with them. And part of this long-standing history with them has been using bees for medicinal purposes. You and I have been reading a lot of different articles over the last week, starting with a Wikipedia article for me personally.
That's the best place to start for basic information a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So it'll lead you to other articles.
Yeah.
When you think about Wikipedia, not to be too tangential, you know, it's maybe take everything with a grain of salt, but it's definitely a good place to start if you know nothing about a subject.
It's a clearinghouse of information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe lead you to some actual papers to read through. But we did get some peer-reviewed literature, some case studies. We had a couple of meta-analyses that we read through, some bee culture articles. And we're going to include all of this information in the show notes so that you can peruse it if you would like. But if you were to describe apitherapy in general to our listeners, how would you describe it?
So apitherapy is a broader term for the use of any bee or bee product for medicinal purposes. So that includes bee stings, which is a sub kind of bit of apitherapy called bee sting therapy. But it also includes the use of honey, the use of royal jelly, the use of beeswax, and bee pollen for medicinal purposes, which, not to get too far ahead, maybe we'll talk about this a bit, but I don't get it. Like, at least some of it. When okay. you talk about bee pollen, that's literally just pollen that's been collected by bees. It's the same as the pollen out in the flowers. You could go collect that pollen yourself.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll set the tone for the rest of the show. I'm sorry to jump ahead. But,
no, it's okay. We're scientists. Let's be very upfront about this. We are scientists by nature. You and I are both kind of incredulous people. We look for data to support claims. And when you make extraordinary claims, what would you say?
Need extraordinary evidence.
Yes. So when we look at things like apitherapy, and it makes very sweeping claims about the benefits of honey and bee pollen and other things to help people who are suffering from real medical conditions, ranging all the way from multiple sclerosis to rheumatoid arthritis to bacterial infections, Lyme disease is one of those that they point out very often. And we also have seen things about beauty regimens and even like male pattern baldness and impotency. All the way up into cancer. There are claims that these things will help with cancer. So that's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of terrible stuff that happens to people. And if you're going to make claims that you can use bees and bee products to cure or improve the lives of people who are going through those kinds of conditions, I need to see the proof in the pudding, right? I need to see some really strong evidence that that's the case.
Yes, and especially when, you know, if it's just cosmetic things, I would personally require maybe less proof because it's not, sure. If it doesn't work, it doesn't affect you that much. But when it's something like bee stings will cure cancer, you know, if you're wrong, that person will die.
Right, right.
So when literally a life is on the line, you know, you've really got to have the evidence to back that up.
And there has been a lot of research into this, into apitherapy, into the use of honey or royal jelly and all this other bee product type stuff into helping people out. Some of the data seems to indicate that these products could help, or components of these products could help with certain medical conditions. But there is a lot of research out there that also indicates that they don't help, and in some cases may even exacerbate certain issues. Yeah. So I think that's the kind of stuff that we got to get out there. Some of the reasons that we're talking about this today is just as, you know, scientific learning requires looking into things that you don't know if they work and taking a stern look at the evidence that is presented, right?
Yes. And I think today we're going to focus mostly on just bee sting therapy because for a variety of reasons, it has the most research. It also has the most potential to go wrong.
Yeah.
I think.
It's also the one that people are the most interested in. It's the one that catches people's attention a lot.
So you mentioned before we started the show, as an introduction to bee sting therapy, you wanted to talk basically about bee stings and why they sting.
Yes.
Is an introduction to that. So,
why do I get stung sometimes, Mike?
Because bees are defending themselves.
Why do they think I'm doing?
Well, you're a big, scary predator that might rip their nest apart.
I do resemble a bear in some ways.
There.
But they think that I'm going to rip into their nest, eat their honey, and eat their babies.
And they don't know the difference between you and a bear. To them, you're a big, scary animal that could destroy the nest, eat their babies, eat their honey, make it so their hive can't survive the winter or doesn't survive at all. And, you know, they want to live. So,
what makes bees special? Because there's lots of insects in the world, but not all of them are able to defend themselves in this fashion. So why do they sting? What is special about bees?
So bees and other Hymenoptera, which are things related to bees like wasps, non-honeybee bees, and some other things, they have modified the ovipositor, which is the organ that the females use to deposit eggs.
Okay.
Some of them have modified it into a stinger that can deliver venom.
So they can't lay eggs anymore?
So, no. in short. So honeybees, the workers are all sterile. And so they don't use their ovipositors to lay eggs anymore. They use their ovipositors for stinging. And it's only the queens that lay the eggs. Similar to paper wasps and other social hymenoptera, they have a sterile worker class that doesn't lay eggs, and then the queens that do.
Okay. So it's like a contract. They don't get to make eggs anymore, but they get to defend their relatives because they have this weapon?
Yes. And there's we can have a whole podcast on why that works genetically. But honeybees are different because unlike a lot of other social wasps and bees, they have barbed stingers. So honeybees will sting you, and the stinger stays in you. And when the honeybee moves away, they rip out their insides and leave the venom sac behind you. So the stinger's in you, the venom sac's attached to it, and it continues to pump venom into you after the bee leaves. But because it's very good bee venom sac noises.
Thank you.
After the bee leaves, because they've ripped their insides out, they will go off and die. Most other bees and wasps don't have barbed stingers, so they'll sting you and then fly away, or sting you and then sting you again and sting you again.
They do like to sting you again and again. I've been
they
there.
They do. But that's kind of one quirk of honeybees, is the barbed stinger and the death associated with it.
And it's interesting to point out that this barb gets stuck in mammalian skin, correct? Not in necessarily an insect exoskeleton. So they can attack other insects successfully without losing their sting. But when they get us, it's not going to end well for them.
I did not know that.
Oh.
Is that true?
That's what I have been reading in a lot of these articles that we have been
perusing. Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. Apparently, the thicker the skin, the epidermis, the more the barb gets stuck in it. And so that's what leads to their guts getting pulled out as they pull away from the sting.
Oh, see, I learned something today.
That's what the podcast is for, Mike. That's what it's for.
All for my knowledge game, not for our listeners.
No, for everybody's knowledge game. When they sting us, they have that sting, and it gets stuck in us, and they pull away. So let me ask you this. Have you ever been stung by anything?
Oh, yes. Lots of times.
Yeah? Like what?
I mean, honeybees. I've also been stung by bumblebees, paper wasps, yellow jackets, basically all of the stinging hymenoptera.
Fire ants? You ever get in that?
As a child, I did. I went fishing.
Okay.
Down on a vacation in Myrtle Beach, and I put my squid next to me because I was using it for a bait, and apparently there's a fire ant nest. They came to the squid, and I got stung all up and down my legs.
And these all produce different sensations of pain, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's actually a guy, Schmidt. He's an entomologist who's created the Schmidt Pain Index. It ranges from 1 to 4.
Right.
And the more painful it is, the higher it is.
Right.
I think bumblebees are like a 1 or a 2. They're not too painful.
No, they're not too high on the list. I think the top of his list is a tarantula, hawk wasp, and yes, a couple of others that are. A bullet ant is pretty high, if I remember correctly. He describes it as exquisite pain, like dropping a toaster in a full bathtub. He has a very poetic way of describing all of the different stings that he's encountered. But
that's a whole other podcast, too, is how people like experience pain differently, and how do you describe pain when like it's really just an internal thing?
Right.
How do you get that across?
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
For example, my daughter has red hair, and I've been reading about it, and apparently they experience pain differently than other people. I don't understand why quite yet, but I'm going to keep reading about it. But apparently she'll experience cold and warm and pain differently than I will as a brown-haired person.
Really weird. Yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah, that's what I didn't either. That's what happens when you start reading about stuff.
Yeah.
So with all this different venom and all these different animals, it can be made up of lots of different sort of constituent particles, lots of different things that can be in the venom that cause pain, right?
Yes. And that really gets at the point of what is the point of venom. So for bees, it's defensive. For honeybees, it's defensive.
Okay.
They want to drive away whatever mammalian predator is trying to destroy their nest. So honeybee venom works really well at causing pain in mammals like us.
Like us.
Other wasps will use their venom for other purposes, such as paralyzing insect prey or killing insect prey, or driving away other kinds of predators that aren't necessarily mammals or large mammals. So, and then when you get out of the realm of insects, you know, you have all kinds of other venomous animals, reptiles and fish and things. And all of that venom is composed of different kinds of proteins because they're doing different jobs.
And with bee venom, it has several different cool things in it that are good at causing pain. When I was reading through one of the bee culture articles that we're going to post in the show notes, the person who wrote it talked about apparently 88% of bee venom is just water. And that seems sort of pointless when you think about pain, but apparently that makes it really good at dispersing into moist tissue, such as our bodies. And so when it's injected into us, it just like goes out into the moist tissue that's all around it because it's so high in water. If you were to just measure the dry weight of bee venom, then you start to find more things like melatonin, which is a peptide compound, and it is the main pain-causing agent within honeybee venom. It's also one of the main things that people are interested in when they're going through bee venom therapy, which we're going to talk about here in a moment. But it causes red blood cells to burst and blood vessels to expand, which I have to assume it induces in order to get the venom to be transported further throughout the body. Don't you think that makes sense?
Yeah. Definitely.
So it's got melatonin, it's got, and I'm going to butcher some of these probably, phospholipase, which is a protein that destroys cell membranes. That sounds fun, right? You want to have that happening in your body. And that equals a lot of pain and inflammation at the sting site. There's histamine, which causes fluid loss in our capillaries, and it's what leads to itchy red spots. It's what leads to allergic reactions.
Oh, that's why antihistamines help.
That's right. And then we have apomin, which destroys nerve tissue, you know, really getting down into the nitty-gritty here. And hyaluronidase, which leads to the reaction spreading throughout the body. So we've got lots of different proteins and peptides and different things in the venom that they're, that it's a cocktail of pain is what we're trying to say. This is, this is put together so that it spreads quickly, it destroys things in its path, and it makes it hurt, itch, and burn at the sting site so that you don't want to mess around with them anymore, like you said before. Bee venom is technically odorless. There is a pheromone that's released when they sting you because there's a pheromone gland at the shaft of the stinger that's activated that attracts more bees to sting you, and they can smell it for a while.
But I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to mention the pheromones in bee stings.
Yeah. So go on. Tell the listeners a little bit about that.
Okay. So basically that, when the bee stings you, there's pheromones released, and it's a cue that other bees should also sting you. So if you're a bear attacking a nest and you get stung, then all of the other bees are cued in to sting you because now you're covered in these pheromones that agitate them. It's also the reason that Africanized honeybees are such a problem, because it's not that they're necessarily very different from European honeybees, but they are much more cued in to these stinging pheromones. So while a European honeybee, you know, they'll release the pheromones and some others might come over and sting you, Africanized honeybees are whipped into a frenzy by the pheromone and, you know, will sting and sting, and more of them will come and more of them will come. It's why they're such a problem. They're just very agitated by this sting pheromone.
Yeah. And you don't want to have that on you. I've heard that I've smelled it once or twice and I don't remember anything really about it, but I've had people describe it to me as smelling like bananas, and that's why you shouldn't eat bananas and go to a beehive. Have you ever heard that?
I have not.
I haven't looked into that in terms of data or anything, but it is something that interests me. I might talk to some of the beekeepers I know if they avoid bananas before they go out to their hive. But the venom itself is odorless. It is also slightly acidic, which is interesting to me because I wonder if that's what led to people putting baking powder on their bee sting sites, because I never understood that. Even as a kid, I got stung a bunch once, and my mom made this baking powder paste and applied it all over my foot where I was stung. And I was like, the problem isn't on the top of my skin, it's inside my body. So I don't understand how this is helping. But apparently,
yeah, I had that done too, and yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah, I think my assumption here would be that since it is an acidic product, and that's probably been knowledge for a long time, that if you used a basic thing like baking soda, maybe it would make it hurt less, but it's not getting into where we need it to be. So I don't think that that's necessarily going to help too many people out. But that's all inside of the venom, causing lots of issues for you as a person receiving that sting. And when I describe all that and when I read through all that, it sounds to me like stuff I personally would not want in my body.
Right. And, well, and not to interrupt, I think this idea of it being a cocktail of chemicals and proteins and peptides, that's something that we'll come back to
absolutely
towards the end of it. So just keep that, listeners, in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
As we talk about the bee venom therapy.
I go out of my way not to get stung, but when you talk about bee venom therapy, you're talking about people who are taking bees and usually with a pair of tweezers picking them up, or having a practitioner of bee venom therapy pick them up and put them on the skin and have them sting you. This can be done about 5 or 6 times in the span of an hour, where every 10 minutes they put another bee on you to get stung. Some people in the reports that we read through have this done to them about 80 times in a day. They receive 80 stings over the course of a day.
I saw that, 60 to 80 stings in a day, and that seems incredibly high.
Yes. So when you get that venom into you, what is the bee venom therapist's hope? What are they trying to induce?
Well, I think it depends on the condition that you're trying to treat.
That's a good point. So what are some of the conditions that they're trying to help out with?
So there's a bunch of them. And this, to me, is a classic kind of whistle that maybe this isn't a good therapy, because some of the websites you go on, they'll claim that they can treat up to 500 different symptoms and ailments.
Wow.
You know, like we mentioned before, everything from cosmetic things to plaque psoriasis to multiple sclerosis, musculoskeletal pain, cancer, just about any kind of ailment you can think of, they'll claim that bee venom treatment helps. And we can pick a couple of these ailments and talk about why bee venom therapy may or may not work for the specific ones. So,
a lot of the literature we read through was about multiple sclerosis. So
that's true.
Let's talk a little bit about that. What are they hoping is happening in your body when you get stung by bees when you have multiple sclerosis?
So with MS, I'm honestly not quite sure what they think it's going to do. So multiple sclerosis is a condition where your immune system attacks your nerves, and it results in a symptom called demyelinization, where the myelin around your nerves is eaten away, and so your nerves misfire. Mm-hmm. So I'm honestly not sure what they think in the bee venom is going to stop that.
So when I was reading through some of this, I guess that's what I kept coming back to as well, that we're talking about multiple diseases, some of the main ones that they're trying to treat, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, a few of those others that are, they're auto...
Very different.
They're kind of autoimmune, right? It's your immune system attacking your body. So why would you put more pressure on the immune system to get active? Because that's right. What's happening with bee venom is the immune response in our body is very powerful. Our body sends out all these antibodies to try and deal with the bee venom. I don't know if the hope is you're giving your immune system something to actually do rather than to attack healthy nerve sheaths in MS. The one paper that I really was reading through, or maybe it was just an article, talked a lot about that the point is this melanin induces cortisol release, which is the natural version of cortisone that we often apply topically to our skin. I think you've done that when you've gotten tarantula hairs in your hand.
That's a story for a different day.
And it's also something that doctors prescribe for people with immune disorders. Now, the article that I was reading through argued that it leads to liver toxicity, and it's not natural. It's a synthesized version of cortisol, and so it's inferior to the actual natural product that our body produces. Now, that's a lot to pick through, I would argue. There's a lot of things in there, wouldn't you say? Like natural, that bias towards wanting to use things that only come from our bodies or from the earth. And a lot of the papers that we read through seem to indicate that this isn't successful, that the meta-analyses point out that this isn't really helping. Is that right?
Right. So especially with multiple sclerosis, there's been a couple studies that have been done in mice that are, because of specific mutations, they have their good multiple sclerosis models. And in those mice models, there has been no effect no effect from the bee venom, or multiple sclerosis was worsened. And there have been two studies done in humans, and they also found that there was no effect when you look at the data.
Okay. Now, when we say that, we're talking about they injected real bee venom into these people, right?
Yes.
Or used bee stings themselves to do it.
Yes.
So some of the work out there does seem to indicate that there are some benefits to this. And people, when they see data that contradicts each other like that, they often immediately think scientists don't know what they're talking about, or one of the groups or both have made it up, right? That we're trying to muddy the water. And I would argue that that's not the case, that maybe we're looking at a situation where there's something in bee venom that could be helpful medicinally, which we've seen happen with lots of other natural products, right? So conceivably, if we could synthesize and mass produce melatonin, or whichever component of the chemical cocktail we laid out for you, maybe if we could create that on our own and mass produce it, maybe it could help with something, with one of these 500 conditions that are listed on different kinds of websites. Like, that's not inconceivable, I don't think.
Right. Well, I was going to bring that point up, too. Like, there have been heart medicines that have been developed out of scorpion venom.
Okay, yeah.
And those heart medicines are great when you use them, but you also don't want to go sting your heart with a scorpion.
Right. So I think that you and I, coming at this as entomologists and scientists, my main issue is the breadth of diseases that there's a claim for cure of, or even just, I guess, therapy of. I mean, it is called bee venom therapy, so that implies it's not curing you, it's just making you feel better.
So maybe it would help to just talk about some of the, keep going along with some of the diseases that claim that it's claimed that bee venom therapy helps, and some of the studies that have backed up or not backed up those claims.
Yeah, lay it on me.
So getting back to the multiple sclerosis, we mentioned that none of the studies in animals or humans have backed up any of the claims that it helps. It actually, there's suggestion that it may worsen multiple sclerosis, which is bad.
Yes.
In a couple places I was reading suggests that multiple sclerosis in particular could be people that suffer from it could MS could be subject to what's called confirmation bias. So the problem with MS is that it comes and goes randomly. Sometimes even just a significant temperature difference can bring on an onset or stop it. And it's not really clear oftentimes what causes the immune system to attack the nerves. And so you can have these random bouts of bad MS, and it's not really clear why. And so when somebody stings themselves with a bee and the MS randomly clears up for other reasons, those people will,
they'll put two and two together and get five.
And they'll give the bee venom the credit for it, even when it was something else, and they'll go out and tell other people. But the problem is the people that have MS and it doesn't work, they're not going to go out as vehemently and proclaim, no, bee venom therapy didn't work for me. So the only people that are saying, hey, it works, are the people who just happen to have the MS clear up at the same time that they did the bee venom therapy. And so it's confirmation bias, because the people that it doesn't work for aren't making similar claims.
I was going to say, what do we call that in terms of science philosophy? But yeah, confirmation bias is a big problem. We also, in one of the articles we read through, we read about publication bias, which is that we as scientists tend to promote and publish work that has positive results rather than negative results. So if there ever is a study that says, well, actually, there seems to be some promise here. That will get published over an article that says, actually, this doesn't work. Negative data is often discarded or put to the side in the publication world.
Correct.
Yeah, so it's that can lead to a lot of these issues. We also have some problems, I would say, looking through the literature, that there's not a lot of peer review going on for some of these studies that promote.
Yeah, either not a lot of peer review or just not a lot of articles being published on it at all.
Right.
So a good example of that would be looking at recalcitrant plaque psoriasis. So this is plaque psoriasis that is resistant to other forms of medication or other ways to clear it up. It doesn't really matter what you throw at it. It doesn't go away. There was one study out of India where they stung the plaque psoriasis with bees, and in 95% of the participants, the plaque psoriasis cleared up. So that, it's one study, so you can't draw a whole lot of conclusions from one study. It needs to be repeated, but, you know, it apparently in this case has very good results for that one disease. So kind of bringing this all together, you know, it depends on the disease you're looking at. It depends on how you apply it. It depends on maybe this one, you know, it's the one in 1,000 times the study is done that they'll get great results at random. And so it got published in the other 999 times you do it. You won't get these results, but because they're negative, those never get published. So it could be confirmation, or it could be publication bias.
Or it could work.
It could work.
Yeah, or there could be something.
The problem is there's promising data. It's just needs to be followed up in a systematic way.
Yes.
To really say anything about it. You can't draw conclusions from one person saying bee sting therapy worked for me, but you also can't draw conclusions from one study that says that, because it's just one.
Science is replication.
Correct.
Replication within a individual study, and then replication of that study throughout time.
Right.
To continually prove it, or not prove it. We don't like to say prove, right?
Right.
To continually support it, or to disprove the supposition of that original study.
So there's a couple other things, disorders that we found information for. So bee venom therapy for pain reduction, specifically for musculoskeletal pain, and things like tennis elbow, shoulder pain after stroke. There's actually a decent number of studies that look at these, maybe half a dozen. All of them have found some pain reduction in most of the patients. So, again, it's suggestive that there's something in the bee venom for this very specific disorder or pain that it could work for.
Right.
But at the same time, we need more peer review. We need it done in a systematic way. Most of these studies have had low numbers of participants, like 10 or fewer. So we need to have some large-scale studies with dozens to hundreds of participants, because even with replicated studies like this, there's so few people per study, it still could be random chance. So, you know, we need to basically move from the next step of there's promising results to bigger studies to look at this. And, you know, getting back to venom as a cocktail, it may be, yes, something in the venom really does work for pain reduction. If you pull that one constituent part out and just use that, you'll get great results without having to be stung by bees.
Because I think that's important to point out, and sort of to conclude our thoughts on some of these studies. There was a meta-analysis that we read through that said that there's a pretty high probability of negative reactions, that people
Yes.
going through bee venom therapy to get healed or to have therapy, they have about a 30% chance of suffering some sort of allergic reaction or worse, even an anaphylactic event.
Yeah, and about 10 to 15% suffered some kind of anaphylactic reaction where your whole body has a reaction and it's not just localized.
Right. So it's not just itching and pain. It's a life-threatening.
It could kill you.
Yeah. And more exposure over time to bee venom can increase your chances of getting this anaphylaxis. So
right. And there was one example where a person that wasn't sensitized to bee stings had bee venom therapy over a course of months, became sensitized and then was stung just out and about and almost died from it because now they're allergic to bee stings when before they weren't.
Yeah. So I guess that would be my big point is a lot of people that look at treatments like this, they say, well, what's it hurting if it's just a natural therapy? I mean, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. I would say that's why.
It can kill you.
Yeah, it can kill somebody. It could lead to people not getting actual treatment.
Right.
It could lead to sensitization where you become allergic to bees and you could be killed by them. So I know this is a controversial topic. We waded into some controversial waters here. I hope that we talked about it with respect. I didn't come at this thinking, you know, oh, this is crazy or anything. I came at it with a scientific eye. I would argue Mike does that with everything in life. So I'm sure he did that.
I try
with this as well, but I would be super excited if we found out that something in bee venom could be medically important. I mean, that would be amazing. That's right. Science. Well, that's progress.
Like we mentioned, it's like the scorpion venom. There's very likely, given the number of components to bee venom, there's likely something there that is medically relevant to certain diseases.
So more research, more randomized, replicated research with some strong peer review over it is needed. I would also argue that we probably need to break bee venom down into its constituent parts and really look at each of those in depth and make sure that, you know, what if we could do this without the bees? I know that that's part of the appeal is it's a natural, one of the articles said it's a self-sterilizing, self-replicating sting apparatus because, you know, they just make themselves go. But there's a lot of stuff in the venom that is just painful. And right. So if we could do away with that and only use the beneficial portion, I think that would be a vast improvement over just getting stung by bees.
Well, and one thing we didn't mention too is you can get there's skin tests that you can do to see if you're sensitized to bee stings. And a lot of people that are doing bee sting therapy are just doing it out of their own hives or collecting bees off flowers and stinging themselves with it. There are practitioners that do it as a job, and if those practitioners are ethical, they can do the skin tests to see if you're sensitized to bee venom and weed out anybody that it might kill. So, you know, as a side, we don't, as a podcast, endorse bee venom therapy in its current form, but if you're going to do it, go to a licensed practitioner so at least you don't run the risk of killing yourself.
So yeah, we don't endorse going out and doing bee venom necessarily, but if you're going to do it, definitely go to somebody who is certified.
Well, and it's important too, I think, if you're going to do it, to continually get the allergy test to make sure you're not sensitizing yourself into having an anaphylactic shock later.
Absolutely. With that, we thank you for listening. We hope that you learned a little something about bees and bee venom today. And if you want to find us on the internet, you can find the blog at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. Find us there. Give us a comment. Tell us how you like the show. You can find us on Twitter. I am at @JLarson_UNL. Tweet at me. Let me know if you like my beard or if you want to sting me with bees now, I guess.
And I'm also on Twitter at @mscavarla36, MSKVARLA36.
I
really should have thought about a better handle when I was making it years ago.
Everybody always asks me how to spell your name, and I'm like, it's just like it sounds. It's just like it sounds.
I know. Just roll the consonants together.
So yeah, find us on Twitter. Find the show on iTunes. Give us a rating. Give us a shout out on there. We'd really appreciate it. And tell your friends. But thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time here on Arthro Podcast.